Hi, folks. The church bells are ringing here at the BioBreak podcast, not to celebrate our 25th episode, although it is our 25th episode and a nice milestone, but to celebrate some exciting vaccine news. We're glad you're here to share it with us. Welcome to BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm joined, as always, by my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
And what are we so excited about this week?
We have a vaccine.
We do. It is on trucks rolling out to people across the United States as we speak.
And I've heard you in, you know, different social media worlds, like, people are signing up, scheduling to get their vaccine. These are healthcare workers. These are not, like, we haven't been able to schedule to get our vaccine yet. We are way, way at the end of the line, and that's okay. But getting our healthcare workers taken care of and getting all these people in nursing homes and rehab facilities, and we need to get them protected.
That's right. So just to set the scene a little bit for where we are, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was granted emergency use authorization late Friday evening. That is not the same as full FDA approval, but that is a step that the FDA can grant under, obviously, emergency situations for things that seem like they will offer, you know, enough benefit to something that is happening right now and we need relief from right now. We've talked about that before. That is the mechanism that was used to grant usage authorization for some of the different treatments and drugs that are available, the remdesivir, the antibody therapies, some of the steroid treatments and other things for treating the symptoms of COVID-19. And now that same procedure has been used to allow this COVID-19 vaccine to be administered to people.
And then did I see that the FDA, there was a panel of scientists that met and went over all of the information, and then they made their recommendations to the FDA. Then the FDA made their recommendations to the CDC, and then the CDC was the one who kind of ultimately...
No, it's the FDA that ultimately has the authority to decide whether or not physicians are allowed to use different treatments and therapies and devices and so forth. They're the ones who decide what can and cannot be used.
Okay. I have to admit, I was kind of skimming headlines and thought I saw something along the lines of, like, the CDC had a say in things.
The CDC is the one who has a panel that provides recommendations on the priority ordering of who gets the vaccine. That's their department. But yeah, it's the FDA that regulates actually what can and cannot be administered and for what reasons.
And, you know, just thinking about how many groups there are that are involved in making these decisions. On one hand, you can kind of look at it and be like, all of these people, this just really gums up the work. But I think really what it means is, or what it demonstrates is, there is so much oversight to kind of catch things and make sure that things are you know, double checked and triple checked. And does that seem more?
I mean, you know, reasonable people can always disagree about the exact appropriate amount of bureaucracy and oversight and the trade-offs between speed and getting something to people as soon as possible and making sure that it's safe and effective and all that. But yes, that the whole purpose of that process is to inspire confidence, right? So as you talked about, there is not just the FDA that looks over things just to make sure that they're doing their job properly. They have this outside panel of experts and scientists that they take advice from. And that would be the same on any drug or vaccine or anything that they are recommending for emergency use or for full approval. They're going to get that outside oversight.
And these are scientists. These are not scientists from Pfizer. These are not scientists like from any of these other, you know, pharmaceutical companies. They are not paid to sit on these.
Yeah, I don't know the exact, you know, provenance of all the different scientists, but no, they are not coming from Pfizer. They are an outside board of scientists who are not associated with whoever the manufacturer or provider is for whatever is being reviewed, and they're not from the FDA. They're not FDA staff scientists. They are, you know, generally speaking, either working for university research in areas, you know, relevant areas of vaccine development or drug development or whatever it is, biomedical research at maybe other companies or other government institutions like the NIH. And that, you know, they're providing their expertise on, they're the ones who are going to know the most about this particular drug, vaccine, disease, etc. The FDA can't obviously have a staff of scientists who are all experts on all the different possible things that you could submit a drug or a device or a vaccine for approval to the FDA for. So that's why they assemble these panels for different things so that they get the most relevant expertise to answer these kinds of questions. And so that, they're not just saying, hey, Pfizer, is this vaccine okay? And Pfizer says, yeah, sure, it's fine. Go ahead and let people have it. No, they don't want to do that. They want to make sure that there is an independent review. And so they're getting as raw data as possible from Pfizer. They're not even saying, well, crunch the numbers for us, Pfizer, and tell us how it turned out. No, they're going over the data themselves. And that's why it took a little bit of time from when Pfizer announced their results of their clinical trial and said, we think it's 95% effective, and we think the safety profile is acceptable, and that's why we're going ahead and applying for this emergency use authorization. But the FDA doesn't say, okay, well, if you say it's 95% effective, then it must be 95% effective. They want to see the numbers. They want to see the raw data. How many people got sick? What did they get sick with? What were the symptoms like? And they're going to do their own analysis. They're going to do their own calculation. Do they get 95% effective also? Mm-hmm. And what is the safety? Do they have the same assessment of the safety profile as Pfizer? Mm-hmm. Because, again, reasonable people might come to different conclusions, even looking at the same data, to say, no, we don't think this is safe enough. Because obviously Pfizer and BioNTech, they have some best interest in having this roll out. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they certainly, nobody wants to be behind a product that ultimately winds up causing harm when it's intended to do good. But, incentives can get goofy and people can make unconscious, can be biased in unconscious ways. They're not just taking their say-so that the safety is okay. They're going to make their own assessment. Are we comfortable with the level of side effects and reactions and things to roll this out to the 300 million Americans mm-hmm. that we are responsible for?
Well, and, thinking about it, how broadly this is impacting everybody, all of these people who've been involved in this, they have parents, they have grandparents, they have friends, they have neighbors, they have people all around them that are being touched by this. So that is a huge motivating factor to make sure you're putting something out that is safe and going to help and going to, get us all, closer to being back to normal.
Right. And you're talking about something that hopefully, theoretically, is going to be administered to every person in the country. And so you can't just think, oh, well, I'm going to let this, drug slip out the door and some other, fool or whatever is going to take it. And if they have a problem, it doesn't impact me. I'm not saying anybody ever operates like that. But if you if you want to imagine, that they're sort of greedy and cynical and so forth.
We have plenty of movies where that's what they're portrayed as.
Sure.
I always talk about the evil scientist.
This is a situation where it would be, against their own personal best interests to let something out that isn't as safe as it could be because, they're, like I said, their mom, their spouse, their children, their relatives, their neighbors, their friends are all, in theory, going to get this vaccine. Maybe not this specific one, but they don't know who's going to get which one. And they certainly don't want to, hope, well, ours is bad, but they'll get somebody else's. Like, nobody's going to think like that. That's not to say that, mistakes can't happen. That's not to say that you can just rely on that kind of thinking and trust everybody in the process. Yeah. They're not saying we shouldn't also review the data. It speaks to the underlying motivations and kind of logic of, well, what would even cause somebody to fudge things intentionally?
Yeah. Well, I guess this kind of, should we talk about the reasons, like there were people who didn't recommend it? In that panel, were you looking at why that was something that I was interested in?
Can you share a little bit more about what you saw?
So what I saw was that it was overwhelmingly the group was in favor of recommending it. And I happened to catch an interview from one of the scientists who didn't recommend it. And the article explained that her withholding her recommendation was based on the age designation, was that they were asking for approval for ages 16 years old and up. And this particular individual didn't feel that there was quite enough data to support for 16 and 17 year olds. And then that was it. And there wasn't anything that was calling into question the impact, you know, how it would affect a 16 year old. But that was, and I was impressed with, you know, that explanation, I guess.
Yeah. And that makes sense. You know, so it's not that there is positive evidence of a problem. There's just some people felt there wasn't sufficient evidence and that there wasn't a problem, yeah. You know, and that it had been tested enough.
And it wasn't that they hadn't tested on 16 and 17 year olds, just
so they want to see more data.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's reasonable. Again, reasonable people are going to make different trade-offs about some of these decisions of, you know, waiting to make sure that you absolutely got every last question answered and trying to help as many people as possible as quickly as possible. You know, I would imagine that looking at the priority charts and the ways that we're rolling out the vaccine, I'm going to guess that not too many 16 or 17 year olds are going to get these early doses. And so hopefully we'll get some more.
But what if we have Doogie Howser?
That is entirely possible. That, you know, there are a few out there. But yeah, the ranks of our healthcare professionals and certainly the, you know, the residents of our long-term care facilities don't tend to skew that young. But it, you know, it's not to say it's not possible, because there are long-term care facilities for all kinds of different folks. And so, it's something to be aware of. And you know, ultimately states are going to make different decisions about, or have the possibility of making different decisions about exactly who gets it first. And, you know, individual people may be able to make a decision in conjunction with their physician of whether they're going to pursue getting it first. You know, if you are a younger person, but you happen to be in one of these categories for whatever reason.
Well, I think I also heard that they've already started doing the trials on children.
They were expanding the phase 3 trial. So, and maybe I haven't been clear about this in the past. The phase 3 trials are still going. Like they kind of reached a specific endpoint of we've follow these people for a few months after their doses and to monitor the initial safety profile and to measure the efficacy. But they're going to continue to follow those people for longer to understand the longer term safety and also the longer term protection benefits. And so those people will still be enrolled in that study. So the study isn't closed. It just reached an endpoint where they felt that they could apply for this emergency use authorization. And so they are continuing to enroll people in these studies and enrolling people younger, so getting down to like the age of 12, enrolling people in other groups of having a particular history of disease or other older populations, making sure they're getting a wide spectrum of ethnicities and races, although that, you know, there was a lot of work already done in the initial recruitment for that. Now that the initial results have been positive, that's a reason to say, okay, now we can take that step further and try it in groups that maybe if they were going to have issues, these are the folks that may be more likely to have issues, and so we don't want to be giving them something first. Mm-hmm. If it turns out that it actually, you know, doesn't have a good safety profile even among younger healthy people, mm-hmm. right? Then we don't want to start with. Folks who are higher risk. And so, so there's still maybe some things that come out about specific populations. Maybe one vaccine is better for them than another. And so they're testing in younger children and so forth. So there will continue to be results from these clinical trials. There will continue to be questions that will be answered. And there's also what they sometimes call sort of phase 4 clinical trials. They will continue to monitor these vaccines now that they're distributing it to the wider population. They're not going to follow up with every single person that gets the vaccine the same way that they follow up with the people who are enrolled in the phase 3 trial. It's not an actual formal phase 4 trial. It's not, mm-hmm. but there is this sort of post-market analysis or tracking where if people do have reactions, that gets reported, and then somebody's analyzing to see, you know, is that more than you would expect kind of by chance? Because, you know, some number of people are going to, by coincidence, get the vaccine and then have some other health episode unrelated, but they want to make, you know, so is it just, does it look like that? Is it that frequency of that, or is there some representation of this issue among the people that have recently gotten the vaccine. So they can continue to be looking for those kinds of things. And so, yeah, we will continue to be learning more about the vaccine, but everything that we've seen up until this point suggests that it is safe and effective to give to, you know, certainly that 18, you know, obviously, apparently everybody agrees about that. There's some questions about the 16 to 17-year-olds, but that adult population is good to go.
And so has there been... I know, you know, a lot of people have compared this, have used the flu vaccine to kind of compare to. Is there any concern that this is a two-dose vaccine? Is there concern that this might be a yearly two-dose vaccine? Or, you know, are we still waiting to see?
Yeah, I mean... anything can happen, so we can't get a definitive answer right now. We can kind of look at some initial indications. So one thing that we can look at, one of the reasons why we have to get a different flu vaccine every year is because it's actually a slightly different vaccine some years. The exact biochemistry of the virus that's in the vaccine is different from one year to the next because the strains that are circulating have mutated, and so they present a slightly different protein or antigen to the immune system. And so you need a slightly different vaccine to make sure that you're getting the best possible match to the virus that's circulating now. And so what we have seen is that with this coronavirus, mutations are not fixing in the population as quickly as happens with the flu vaccine, What that means is that it's not just that the mutation occurs in like one virus in one person, but that of all the virus that's circulating, a particular change becomes predominant or in all of the viruses. And so we're not seeing as frequent or as rapid changes with this coronavirus as we are with the flu. So that's one reason to think that this vaccine will protect, if not lifelong the way that a lot that some vaccines do, or for, you know, for many, many years the way that some vaccines do, that at least will offer multi-year protection because the virus isn't going to change that much in a few years to require a different vaccine.
And I think I saw that the big result of the vaccine is it also, it affects the, like, the severity of the disease that you get. Like, you still might, and I don't want to say the wrong thing, so maybe you should just take over.
Sure. So let's finish the other point first, because the other side of that is, how does your body react to the vaccine? Does it make enough of an immune response to persist for more than a few months? And time will ultimately tell, but from what we can measure from the initial reactions, people develop quite a robust immune reaction to this vaccine, and the different things we can measure about numbers of antibodies and T cells and different things suggest that it will provide longer lasting immunity, at least again for a few years. Doesn't mean that, you know, something can turn out differently than we expect, and that actually, you know, next year we'll all be getting, well, next year all of us will be getting this vaccine, yeah, you know, 2021. Maybe in 2022 we'll be doing this all again for a slightly different variation. But the best guess that we have right now, the best prediction that we have right now, based on how quickly the virus changes and how strongly our immune systems react to this particular vaccine, is that it shouldn't be an annual process, but we will continue to see. In terms of what the vaccine actually does, that's a good question. So what they have found is that there were, when we say 95% effective, basically what that means is that 95% fewer people in the group that got vaccine went on to develop COVID-19 compared to the people who got the placebo injection. And so, you know, if you want to put it in round numbers, if there are 100 people in each group, 100 people got COVID-19 in the placebo group, and 5 people got COVID-19 in the vaccine group, is how those numbers, you know, one way that those numbers fall. Obviously, that's not the exact numbers, but yeah. That's the kind of scale we're talking about. Now, of those people in the vaccine group that did get COVID-19, they all had a mild form of the disease. There were no hospitalizations and no severe outcomes or deaths. So it seems to be, you know, essentially 100% effective at preventing severe illness. That may, you know, that may turn out to be actually 99.9, 99.8%, something like that, once we get out to a wider population. But in the size of the group that was studied, there were no instances of severe illness in the placebo group. There were some cases of severe illness in the there were no instances of severe illness in the vaccine group. There were some instances of that in the placebo group, consistent with what we would expect mm-hmm. in the wider population. If you get the vaccine, that doesn't mean that you will definitely not get COVID-19, but it is very promising that if you do get it, it will be a more mild experience. You won't have any of these severe complications that would put you in the hospital that are the biggest concern with this virus and this disease.
Okay, so I guess then I think the other big story that came out, because Great Britain started giving out the vaccine. They had approved the vaccine last week, I guess.
A couple weeks now.
Yeah, they started vaccinating, and there's lots of publicity around the first couple of
yes, candidates. They were celebrities at least for a couple of days.
It was kind of fun to hear William Shakespeare got the vaccine.
Yes.
To which our daughter was quite surprised to know that there are other people who are named William Shakespeare.
I think everybody was quite surprised to learn that there was somebody else named William Shakespeare. It's kind of like jersey numbers in sports. It seems like there's to be some names that just get retired. Who would ever want to have that name again?
But one thing that kind of came out in the news was that there were a couple of healthcare workers that had a severe reaction to the vaccine. So maybe we should talk about that.
So different countries have different approval processes and so forth. And so the United Kingdom went through a different process and approved a similar kind of emergency license to give out the vaccine. A little bit ahead of us, Canada went through a different process and approved it a couple of days before us. Yeah, and you know, the European Union should be soon, and you know, we're going to see different things. They approved it and they had started administering it. Similarly to us, to healthcare workers and to folks in long-term care facilities and other sort of resident healthcare facilities. And among the, I don't know how many tens of thousands, but two out of the however many thousands of people got the first rounds of a vaccine had what they characterizes a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine. So what are we talking about here? So we've talked before about a reaction to a vaccine. You get the injection, and then within hours or a day or so, you have soreness, you have maybe achiness, especially near where you got injected, and you might just feel overall a little bit run down, maybe even a little bit feverish. I know when I get the flu vaccine, most years I wind up feeling, at the very least, a little kind of run down, like 8 hours afterwards, something like that, and it lasts for a couple hours and it passes.
But that's your body doing what it's supposed to do, right?
Right. So that is not what we're talking about here. That is not an allergic reaction to the vaccine. That is an expected and appropriate immune response to trying to start actually making the antibodies and the different kinds of cells that you need to respond to the virus that you want the vaccine to generate. So that is certainly expected. And, some people kind of point to that as that's not a bug, that's a feature. That is your body. That means that, we know the vaccine is working. Like, that's a positive sign that the vaccine is doing what it's meant to do. Even if it does feel kind of crummy for a few hours. And reports about this vaccine are that you're going to have that same kind of reaction. You may feel quite crummy for a couple hours, mm-hmm. Starting about, like, things like 12 hours after injection, especially the second dose, because your body's already kind of primed to respond a little bit. But that is okay. That is normal. Certainly, you can consult with a physician if you experience symptoms and you're concerned and so forth. And you can consult with whoever gives you the injection about what to expect and what's normal and when to seek health care and so forth. But all of that, that kind of general achiness, feeling rundown, fever, that is not this kind of allergic reaction. What we're talking about here is within seconds to minutes of receiving the injection, these people are having an allergic response, the same way you might have an allergic reaction to a bee sting or to...
And they were saying anaphylactic.
Yeah, so it's the same kind of anaphylactic reaction of your body, your whole body just sort of starts to react, swell up, and so there's concerns about closing your airway and all of that. And so these two folks had to receive an EpiPen injection to stop that allergic reaction. These are folks who already had a history of severe allergic reactions. These kind, you know, so they either were the kind of people carrying EpiPens
themselves.
That
I heard they have to carry an EpiPen with them.
Yeah, they knew going into this that not that they were going to have this kind of reaction to this vaccine specifically, but that they have the kind of immune system that has strong allergic reactions to certain kinds of things. Most of us don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of us don't have to carry an EpiPen. Most of us don't have those kinds of reactions to other vaccines. And so, you know, if you're thinking of yourself, with people with allergies, like I, you know, personally have, you know, hay fever, I can get quite miserable, you know, in the spring or the fall or whatever, different pollens and things are out.
We notice.
Yeah. But that's not what we're talking about either. You know, that, yes, if you feel crummy, but it's not life-threatening. It's not something serious. If it went untreated, it would be fine, or I can take an over-the-counter pill and be okay. These are people who know that they have life-threatening allergic reactions to other kinds of things. And so it turns out that some people can have an allergic reaction to this vaccine. Wasn't a guarantee, but it turns out.
And they were able to be, you know, treated, and it's not like the anaphylactic reaction continues to go as the body, you know, processes
Right, that's an immediate reaction, an immediate treatment. It was able to stop that allergic reaction, and that's they're different kinds of immune reactions, and that's a different one than the kind you want your body to make against the virus. So that doesn't mean that they're not going to be able to also have the protective immune reaction. Probably what they're reacting to is something else in the vaccine other than the actual RNA that makes it be a vaccine for this virus, because our bodies are full of RNA, and so it would be very unlikely that you would have an allergic reaction to RNA itself.
And there's information out there. You can, if you are concerned or have a history of having these kinds of reactions, you can get the list of ingredients to what's in the vaccine.
Right. And so in the UK, they halted administering the vaccine to people with that particular history. So not everybody stopped getting it, but people who had a specific allergic history, they said, we're going to no longer authorize that vaccine for use for people with that history for the time being until we can better understand the situation. If that's you, obviously talk to your physician first. If that's you and you aren't in one of the other priority categories, so you don't have a job in healthcare or education or any of those kind of frontline emergency response kinds of jobs, if you're not in one of the high-risk health categories, chances are it's going to be a while before you get the vaccine, and there may be other ones that come out between now and then. The Moderna vaccine has also been submitted for this emergency use authorization, and we may get an answer to that.
We're supposed to hear from that, like, this week.
Yeah. You know, and so that may be an option. That is also an RNA vaccine, and so that in a lot of ways it's very similar to the Pfizer one, but it definitely has some of the other ingredients are going to be different. It may very well be that people who have an allergic reaction to one don't have an allergic reaction to the other because it's the differences in those sort of side ingredients rather than the main ingredients people are reacting to. So that may be an option. How you'll know, we'll have to see, you know, hopefully nobody has a severe allergic reaction to the Moderna one. And so that's the one that is appropriate for people who have those allergy situations. Or maybe it's one of these other ones that isn't an RNA vaccine that is a little bit further down the road, but still in the pipeline, that from Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca or some of these other options. When your time comes, you're going to have a conversation with your physician or some other healthcare professional who isn't familiar with your history and your condition to understand which vaccine might be the best one for you. And in all these cases, you know, when you get these vaccines, you know, they're going to be monitoring people. Because, you know, maybe for whatever reason, you never knew that you had a history of severe allergic reactions, and this is the thing that you respond to. you know, they, oh, that's just kind of going to be standard process for any vaccine, is that people, you know, there's some amount of...
When they're saying because you have to have two doses, they need to, they want to keep track of, you know, you go in, you get your first dose, and then you have to be able to, you know, come back, what, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later to come in. I think they said it was 21 days.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is going to be, you know, individual, you know, follow-ups just to make sure.
Right, but that's kind of longer term. You know, this is just like you're going to have 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
Afterwards, if you haven't reacted by then, you'll be okay.
Okay, so we talked about the allergies. I guess maybe I think it might be good to kind of break down, like, what to expect as, you know, as we start seeing more the first round of people get vaccinated. This doesn't necessarily mean, hey, everything's back to normal. You got to kind of temper the good news with.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the exact timeline is going to depend on how the manufacturing actually goes, and how the distribution goes, and how many people will take the vaccine, in terms of how many weeks and months it is until you personally are able to get your two doses. And it will also vary by state. The CDC has issued recommendations of a prioritization. The states have the opportunity to make their own decisions ultimately, because public health authority rests with the states, not with the federal government. And so most of them are going to follow the CDC guidelines pretty closely, but some states may have different kinds of populations. And so they might decide that they have a bigger group in one of these categories that they're going to put further up on the list or further down on the list, just because of logistics and needs of their particular states. And so all that may vary a little bit, but probably have the same overall shape around the country. And then what they're doing is, you know, basically the federal government is buying the vaccine. And then they're saying, okay, we have, you know, to start with, they have 2.9 million doses. They're going to take that, divide it up so that each state gets doses proportional to the number of people in the state. So they're not looking at how many healthcare workers are there in each state. They're just looking at how many people are there in each state and apportioning the doses that way. And also territories. And I saw, for example, like the Navajo Nation is getting a distribution
of that too.
Vaccines, right? So
yeah.
I say states, but understand that it might mean other kinds of entities equivalent to states or that are also getting things from the federal government. So it gets apportioned out, and then those states will decide, okay, who exactly gets, we have an allotment of 10,000 doses or whatever it is, who gets that, and then they'll distribute it that way via clinics and hospitals and healthcare facilities and however that state has decided to roll it out. And those first people are going to get the vaccine. And they themselves then are now at a much lower risk of getting any kind of COVID infection and have eliminated almost all risk of getting the severe COVID complications. The rest of us will still need to do what we can to prevent transmission, because most of us will not have gotten the vaccine yet. And so we still need to do what we can to reduce the risk of severe illness among people who aren't vaccinated by reducing the risk that they even get infected in the first place. And so that's all the same things we've been doing and talking about. Wearing masks when we're around other people, washing our hands after interacting with things, keeping that distance of at least 6 feet apart, limiting how many people we are gathering together with so that you can't have a big super spreader event all at once. All those good things are going to have to continue for the early months, at the very least, of 2021, just so that we can make sure that we're getting the most benefit from the vaccine once we're finally able to roll it out. If we all wind up getting COVID-19 before we get a chance to get the vaccine, then a lot of this effort may have been for naught. That's not the case where we are right now. You know, most people are still have no history of having been exposed to the virus, and so most people are still in a position to benefit from the vaccine. We just have to make sure that we get them there healthy and safe.
So even with the high numbers that we are seeing, case numbers and stuff, we can still slow it down. We can still, you know, have an impact on just by our choice.
Absolutely.
Which I know, you know, sometimes, you know, as somebody who struggles with big numbers and processing that kind of, you know, broad information, it can be hard to recognize that, but that really is, that's what we can do, and it can make a big difference.
Yeah, you know, human behavior is still the biggest factor, and changes in human behavior are the biggest drivers in when places start to see this upticks in cases, and when places start to see those level off and come down. And so, yeah, we are still the ones who are in the driver's seat, and we get to do what we can to help our neighbors. There have also been some questions brought up about, okay, so the vaccine prevents me from getting sick if I get exposed to the virus. Does it prevent me from passing it on to anybody else? So far, these clinical trials were not really set up to answer that question, at least by this point. And so that is a question that we are still looking to get a definitive answer to. I think the best thing there is just to say, we're going to have to wait and see. And there will be future guidelines about sort of when we can all take a step back from the masks in public and the social distancing and so forth. And that will be based partly on a better understanding of how much the vaccine prevents transmission. Because if I have the vaccine, but I can still transmit it, then if I go around without my mask and I get close to people and close to lots of people, then I can still maybe be spreading it and never know that I even had it mm-hmm. because I never had any of the symptoms because I had the vaccine. But hopefully that won't be the case. But we have to wait and see the answer to that one. And then the recommendations will be adjusted accordingly.
One of the things that just kind of like on a side note, the thinking about the masks and how they're just now part of how we do things, and seeing the impact of how masks can manage things like flu, since we all have them, I kind of wonder if it would be a significant positive if going forward, you know, the idea of wearing a mask during flu season, you know, I think about all the kiddos that come in, you know, when you're teaching, all the kiddos that come in and end up kind of spreading all kinds of those fun germs around, you know, over the colder months. Like, if just even having it become like acceptable that, okay, you know, I'm gonna, you know, my kid's gonna wear a mask to school today. Just, you know, they're not sure if they have something, but they might, and it's just, it could potentially be okay and not a weird thing. And, you know, I guess become more like, I know that's something that has kind of, you know, become part of, you know, the Asian culture, you know, of wearing masks, different, you know more about.
Yeah, so, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, is this situation like the flu, is it not like the flu, and so forth. And, you know, for a lot of biological medical reasons, there are big differences between this virus and the flu. And so, you know, I don't think we can just say, oh, as we've been talking about a lot, that we can just say, oh, this is the same, so we can treat it like the flu. My thought has always been, maybe this will actually get us to, instead of saying, well, lots of people die of the flu and we don't do anything about that, so why should we do anything about this? We should flip that around and say, lots of people die of the flu, and look, we can do things about that. Maybe we should be doing some more things to prevent so many people from dying of the flu. Maybe wearing masks in certain public settings will continue to be more acceptable. Maybe some of these plexiglass barriers and other precautions in retail spaces and so forth will remain part of the landscape. Maybe people feel differently. I don't see where that was necessarily a bad thing, right? It's not preventing me from having a human interaction with a cashier or other retail employee. You know, because you're still seeing that face-to-face. You're making that human connection. We don't generally physically interact anyway. I don't hug every cashier that I run into.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, we're not even, you know, shaking hands or anything, or even exchanging money. Often, you know, you're swiping a card at a little terminal. And so, you know, having that extra barrier to me doesn't change the nature of the interaction in any meaningful way. Other people may feel differently. So maybe that's something that continues. Maybe some of these school accommodations, you're talking about, okay, I'm going to send, you know, little Johnny or Susie with a mask today because I'm not sure how they're feeling. Maybe actually I'm not going to send little Johnny or Susie today because they can do school at home. And so then I'm completely eliminating the possibility of spreading anything that they might have. you know, paid sick, more paid sick leave for more kinds of employees, so that if you are not feeling well as an adult, you can stay home from work and not worry about how am I going to pay for groceries this week because I'm having to miss work without pay, or am I going to still have my job in a week because I'm having to miss work without having that.
I think we've definitely seen that, like, the work landscape change a lot with more and more people recognizing the ability to have, you know, more people work from home and have, you know, I know you know, there's been talk of just having, like, you know, meeting spaces or set times where, you know, to get those kinds of, you know, interactions and stuff, but still recognizing that there's a benefit to a lot of people for being able to work from home. I just think it could be interesting if we take, you know, how the world has looked over the past 10 months and kind of look and see what things actually really work, so that it's not just, it was 2020. Like, what are the things that we can take away and you know, use to really benefit, you know, going forward?
Yeah. You know, so one thing that I learned that I didn't realize is that the 1918 flu pandemic helped, and, you know, you can get different accounts of exactly how critical it was, but you know, that was one of the drivers for the transition, at least in some Protestant churches, to switch to the individualized communion cups. That was a measure that was introduced to prevent, so that we're not all using a common vessel. We're having our individual cups, and so that way we're cutting down on the spread of influenza at that time. And that was something that, you know, stuck. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never knew that in all the years, is drinking out of those little tiny, you know, glass cups or plastic cups, depending on the church and the time. So there may be things about the world that change permanently because of this. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if it helps us to reduce illness and death from other kinds of diseases as well. Hopefully, I also would just like to see a better appreciation for the impact that infectious diseases can have on our lives and our health and our world. You know, we in the United States, because in large part we have vaccines to so many different diseases, and because of our hygiene, and because of some different, you know, insect control programs in the past, you know, there are a lot of infectious diseases that we don't deal with here in the United States that we either used to deal with a lot more often in this country, and or, you know, other countries in the world continue to currently deal with. You know, malaria used to be a thing that spread in the United States, and then we, you know, pushed to eradicate the mosquitoes, and that got rid of malaria transmission in the United States. But, you know, the mosquitoes have come back. There are mosquitoes in the United States that can transmit malaria. There is nothing biologically preventing us from, you know, blocking malaria transmission in the United States from happening. It is the fact that we got rid of it once, and then we're keeping it out through public health measures. You know, same thing for yellow fever. And then, you know, lots of these other diseases, measles, mumps, and so forth. These were things that people got a lot, and now they don't. Obviously, we've seen some measles outbreaks and things in recent years, and mumps outbreaks. But yeah, these are kind of abstract ideas for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And not that I want people to suffer from infectious diseases, but I want people to appreciate that we have to take these things seriously, and that the possibilities are there for the next pandemic to happen. And, you know, we're all still vulnerable to that. There's nothing, you know, magical about the United States that's preventing us from being exposed to that. And so, you know, investing in some public health measures to do that, you know, not just for our own personal benefit, but as, you know, hopefully we're seeing, is that public health is something where we all benefit from, and my actions have an impact on people around me. And it's not just, well, I can either choose to protect myself or not. It's I'm making choices that have a direct impact, and then also an indirect impact on people, lots of people around me, out to several degrees of removal. People I've never met in person you know, I'm having, my choices are having an impact mm-hmm. on their health. And so, you know, trying to think a little bit more about mindset. Just a, you know, there's interesting research on that, you know, getting away from the aspect of infectious diseases for a second. I saw a talk at a conference one time about how your weight, which is a very imperfect, you know, measure of anything other than your weight in terms of health, but it's still something that, for better or worse, you know, we track as a health indicator. And the, you know, so the weight of people around you, your friends and your family and so forth, has some impact on how much you weigh. And then the people that they're around has an impact on your weight. So people that you've never met and never interacted with have like 5 or 10%, you know, like 10% of the variation in, uh-huh. in our weights are predictable based on the weights of people who are 2 degrees removed from us that we may never have interacted with in person. Just because of sort of the behavioral tendencies of,
yeah,
you know, we eat in social groups. We don't eat alone.
Yeah.
You know, and so our choice, we don't exercise alone oftentimes. You know, we go to the gym or we have a group that bikes together or walks together and so forth. We're making these choices as groups, as social units, as communities. And so the decisions that other people are making have an impact on the decisions that I make. And so these things are connected. And
I've heard that also in like business circles. Like that's something that you'll hear entrepreneurs kind of talk about, how, you know, who you surround yourself with has an impact on how successful you are. But it you know, makes you think how, you know, we aren't necessarily as individualistic a group that we think we are. It's a really, I'll be interesting, I guess it's kind of like a sociological kind of study as to how we as a culture are going to kind of balance this idea of being an individual, but also, you know, everybody wants community. Everybody wants to be part of a thriving community. And so, okay, well, we're seeing it right here. You can choose to be an individual or you can choose to be, you know, part of, you know, the broader community and really have an impact by staying home.
In this particular instance, and, you know, and it doesn't have to be staying at home, yeah, you know, and yeah. fully. And that, you know, that's something that we can take away from this is, you know, some of these other countries have been effective through more extensive testing processes and contact tracing and so forth. And the technology for the contact tracing, we may not ever tolerate here in the United States at that level of government sort of tracking. But certainly the testing capacity, right? If we had the ability to, every time there is a case, go in and just test, you know, that whole community or every person that person come in contact with within, you know, 24 hours and figure out, okay, who needs to be, quarantined and who doesn't and all of that. You know, if we could do that faster and more responsive and in greater volume, we wouldn't necessarily have to resort to these broad scale, everybody stay in your home for 3 weeks kind of stuff. Because that isn't the only solution. That isn't necessarily the best solution. It's unfortunately when things get bad enough in different places here in the United States and in other places around the world, that winds up being the only option left when you don't have all these other things to go on. And so, yeah, I think if we could invest more in our public health capacity to do things like testing, then we wouldn't necessarily be looking at, oh, if this ever happens again, we're all back to, you know, living in isolation for so long.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think that kind of story has been lost because there's been so much frustration with the do we open things, do we close things. There hasn't really been the talk of how do we get enough testing to happen. And hopefully that's a problem we can solve in the future.
Yeah, you know, it would be great if, you know, in 6 months' time, once, you know, lots of people have gotten the vaccine and we're kind of able to think about something else other than our immediate circumstances. Hopefully, you know, we get some more economic relief to folks so that they, again, have a little bit more bandwidth to think about other things than how am I going to feed my family in this situation, that we start to think and talk about, you know, how do we create a health, public health infrastructure that benefits us better going forward.
Sounds like we're kind of coming to an end, or at least we've reached a point where we can't solve any more problems.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap up. So if folks have any thoughts or questions on what we've talked about today, if you're excited about the vaccine, if you are one of those healthcare workers or other folks who have gotten the vaccine by the time you listen to this episode or have a schedule and you want to share your experience or your thoughts or just your excitement or your concerns, you know, we'd be happy to hear those. And yeah, if you want us to share them with other people, you know, we can talk about how to do that.
Well, I know you've answered some questions on just, you know, my personal, you know, Facebook page. If you have questions about, you know, the vaccine, I know you can't do everything, and you're not anybody's physician, but you know, you have some knowledge and you're gracious enough to share.
Yeah, you know, certainly there are some things that only a physician is going to be able to answer for you. But things about the science and some of the different options and why might one vaccine be better than another for, you know, particular situations, I'm happy to do what I can in those conversations. So yeah, you can find us, if you don't know Jody's personal Facebook page, you can find us at BioBreakPod on Twitter, or BioBreakPod@gmail.com, and you can search for BioBreak Podcast on Facebook, and we'd be happy to hear from you at any of those places. Until then, keep wearing those masks and washing your hands and be safe.
So before we wrap up, I have one more question. You mentioned bells, and there were bells, and I know that the bells were for the vaccine, but why bells?
Yes, that was an homage to the fact that in April of 1955, when results about the Salk polio vaccine were announced, it was sort of a national day of celebration. Church bells rang, kids were let out of school early, and you know, people, there was sort of a general public excitement about it. And so I'm trying, you know, I just thought it would be good to have some sort of positive celebration and positive acknowledgement of what's going on.
Well, now I'm wishing they would have rang bells on Friday or Saturday.
Yeah,
hard to know the time now.
what was the right day to do it? Was it the day, you know, that the study was released? Was it, you know, late Friday? People would not have been amused if really late Friday night when the decision was made by the FDA.
Just do all the bells all the time, because the year's almost done and we got good things coming.
Sure. But yeah, that was what that was all about.
Okay.
All right, thanks.